We're talking with Dave Politis about a genuine mystery all over North America, not only here in the U.S., but Canada as well. Hundreds of people who've disappeared under strange circumstances, some of them found, very few of them found alive, some of them found under strange circumstances. One of the other characteristics we have not yet touched on, but will, is the fact that some of these people are found in areas that had just been searched. People walk over this ground, they look in this area, they don't see anything, they come back a little while later, and there's the person who'd been taken, abducted, whatever you want to call it. We'll get into that and then into some specific cases from east of the Rockies right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us tonight. I'm George Knapp, talking with Dave Politis, author of the dual volume book, Missing 411. Dave, one of the other characteristics before we get into specifics east of the Rockies deals with the areas that had already been searched. Do you have some examples that could illustrate how weird that gets?
Yes, and that's something that spoke about with the search and rescue folks a lot. And it was something that a few of them had experienced, as a matter of fact. And that is that a child goes missing at a rural ranch in the middle of, on the fringe of a national forest. The search and rescue folks immediately start usually searching as close in as they can and move out. And the further you move out, the less chance, according to the grid search patterns, less of a chance you're going to find the person. And usually when you're in close, you have a large density of people that have already searched the area close, family, friends. And it's at that point when they eventually give up that they call for professionals. Too many times to count, especially a child, it's found in very close proximity to where they disappeared. And a vast majority of those times, they're either found unconscious, and they'll state that in the articles, they're unconscious or they're asleep. And when they wake up, or when you wake them up, you get that response as though a deer in the headlights. They don't know what happened. They don't remember anything. They don't know how they got there, etc.
But they're in an area, it's not just that somebody overlooked them. They're in an area that would be obvious, some of these cases, right? Right out in the middle of a clearing or in a mud bog or something like that.
Or on a trail that the search and rescue people had used for the previous 2, 3, 4 days, and they show up the next day and there's a tree laying across the trail and the child is laying across the limbs of the tree.
It's as if they're snatched by something, they're abducted, they're taken by something, and then brought back.
So what I've had dozens of those emails, yes.
I know we don't want to get too far afield into the area of UFO type abductions because it's not really your area, but I do know that after our interview, you talked to Whitley Strieber. I think you were interviewed by him, and he started delving into that that arena, right?
Well, in fact, Whitley brought up a great point that I didn't know about. And it's one of those elements is that many of the people that disappear, they're wearing bright colored clothing. And I probably would never have keyed on this unless in specific articles, the search and rescue people made a note, oh yeah, she was wearing a bright yellow coat, or they were wearing, he was a surveyor and he was wearing a bright orange vest. And you keep hearing this and hearing this. And Whitley read the book and goes, and when I was talking to him, he goes, Dave, do you know that, this isn't unprecedented. I said, well, what do you mean? Well, there was a researcher in Malaysia, and he sent me the link that there were tribesmen in the outer reaches of Malaysia that knew never to go into the jungle wearing bright colored clothing because it had been historically noted that you would never come back.
Well, a couple things we can take from that is, one, the weirdness of the bright colors, but also the idea that this may not just be a North American phenomena.
Oh, and that's exactly true. In fact, we're under a couple of cases in Australia that when you read them, they almost mimic the elements that we're talking about tonight.
You don't necessarily have to have big trees, then, for this to happen.
No, you don't. In fact, when we start talking about many of the East Coast books, the topography, the terrain in the East Coast is quite a bit different than the Western Sierras, Rockies, etc. And with that comes different elements that get thrown in searchers' faces. As an example, you have a 2-year-old child that disappears, and people start searching, and you walk up to say a swamp area. Okay, so the searchers may drag the swamp, and searchers may ignore the swamp. But one thing you're not going to do, you're not going to cross the swamp and go to an island, because that two-year-old's not going to be able to get to the island. Yet there's probably 10, 12 cases I cite in the book where the person's eventually found on that island, or they're found on laying on a bush in an area that searchers had to go chest deep in order to get there. And it's almost an unfathomable degree of effort to get to the point where the child's at. And when the searchers get there, they're shaking their heads about what they find. Now, how they get there sometimes is there's strange noises that they hear. You know, maybe there's some other element that pushes them to that place that wasn't noted in the article, but there's nothing obvious that gets them there. It isn't a canine that wants to swim across the bog to get there. It's just an inhuman effort to get there. But where they're found is unbelievable.
You said that there is, I remember reading that there is an element where animals are involved, like dogs, where a dog will lead a child or an abduction victim out into some area where they're snatched by something.
So the state of Pennsylvania has more children that have disappeared between, say, 1946 and 1959 than any other time in recent history in the U.S. They have more kids that are missing during those years in that area than, say, a factor times 10 than anywhere in the U.S. And I have a map of Pennsylvania on my wall with all of the disappearances on it, and it's absolutely unbelievable. And we call Pennsylvania a cluster in itself because there's so many kids that have disappeared there. And not only are there clusters there, but there's clusters inside clusters. And going back to my law enforcement days, when a suspect commits a crime, they usually don't commit that crime real close to home for a multitude of reasons. People in the neighborhood know the car. People in the neighborhood may be able to identify you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there's two different areas in Pennsylvania where you could almost make out a circle on the map where kids have disappeared, but inside that circle, there's nothing. And in the far northwestern region of Pennsylvania, there's a huge national forest that borders New York. And right now, there's five disappearances exactly on the perimeter of that national forest, but nothing inside that national forest.
You say right now, meaning these are recent cases?
No, I mean, these cases go back to the 1940s. But if you thought about this rationally, when families and things go into those national forests to vacation or whatever, you'd expect the kids to disappear inside the national forest. Yet these are on residences, rural farms, vacation homes, and things right on the perimeter and not inside. We thought that was really odd. We were talking about this the other day.
You said about Pennsylvania and the cluster or cluster within clusters, and there were certain years where this happened. Did it just stop in that area?
You know, it hasn't just stopped. It's still happening. But the numbers within that year span will just jump right out at you. And the mere number of kids that have disappeared in Pennsylvania has continued on over the years, along with some adults, along with some unbelievable stories, along with those disappearances. And it's one of those few places where there's been double disappearances. Say two kids go away at the same time, they're not found. A year later, they're found on a hillside miles away, laying next to each other dead. Now, if you know anything about human conditions and living and dying and things, chances are, if unfortunately, George, if you and I are hiking and you drop dead, I'm not going to sit there and die with you. I'm going to go get some help. And that inkling to live and that flee or stay
instinct
desire we have inside ourselves, it would almost indicate that somehow or another those kids were placed there on that hillside, both dead.
Almost ritually.
Yeah.
One other point to make, and then we get into specific cases east of the Rockies, and it's about weather. Now, national parks, national forests, wilderness areas, of course, you're going to have inclement weather. But when you say that there are weather anomalies, as you've written in these books, what do you mean by it? Why does it stand out? Why wouldn't that just be a normal kind of a thing to have this kind of bad weather out there?
It's so far beyond a mere coincidence. It's unreal. When, you know, it's difficult sometimes going back 50 years to determine what the weather was when a person disappears or immediately afterwards. But when the articles state, yeah, all of a sudden a storm developed and the storm lasted for 2 weeks that this person was gone and it rained, you know, 20 inches in those 2 weeks, it was a completely unbelievable storm. You start to read about these storms that all of a sudden happen, either when the person disappears or immediately afterwards. And they even talk about it wipes out any evidence of the person being there. There's no tracks. It's harder for the canines to track. Blah, 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 blah. Searchers are compromised because the creek's higher. It goes on and on and on. And it's definitely one of the major elements in these stories.
Almost as if the storms are generated to cover the tracks or to make it harder to locate the missing person.
That's what you would think.
Do you ever have cases where there are anomalous tracks, where you're able to at least track the missing person for a while and there's some other kind of track along with it?
You know, there was, well, tracking the person themselves, there was a small boy named Alfred Bielarts that disappeared in the Great, I'm sorry, in the Rocky Mountain National Park in the late 30s. And him and his folks were walking along a river, and he was the last person there, and all of a sudden he just vanished. Parents were perplexed. Knee-jerk reaction from the Park Service is he went in the river. They actually dammed the river. They searched it for a week. They didn't find him. And they eventually said, he's not in the river. And they bring in a canine, and this canine tracks Alfred up 1,000 foot in elevation, and they get to a fork in the trail, and the dog lays down, and that's like it. And it's a fork in a trail nowhere near a road. It's further up into the wilderness and into this area of very steep, very, very high elevations. Well, unknown to that at the time, there's a family up there, and this family hears something like, I don't know, I think it was 1,200 feet above them or 1,000. I don't know what it was. It was high enough they could hear something. They look up with their binoculars, and they see this little boy on a ledge. And they get a pretty good look at him, and they can't believe he's up there because it's in an area where they said they couldn't get. And they didn't know a boy was missing at the time. They come down, they see all these search and rescue folks, and they have an interview, and they say, yeah, well, we saw a boy way up here. And turns out that that was on the way on this one trail from where this canine laid down and stopped. Well, this area up high was a place called Devil's Nest. And something I write about in the book is that a lot of these people disappear in an area with devil in the name or other strange and uncomfortable names associated with the area. And what I write about is that these areas get their names for a reason. You know, if it's Jones Valley, well, maybe Jones is the one that lived there that developed the valley and named it. Well, if there's unusual things going on in an area or sinister things, they might give it a sinister name. Now, I don't know why Devil's Nest got its name, but Alfred was never found. They put 40 rangers in there for 3 days. They never found him. They never found any evidence of a boy being there, yet a husband and a wife both stayed adamantly that was him and he was there. So.
Let's get into some cases. I don't know if this is a coincidence or not, but after we had you on the program in March, soon after, the Associated Press had a story out of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, about officials in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park talking about lost visitors every year, most of them being found, but three cases jump out at them, what they call the Big Three, in particular, a 6-year-old boy named Dennis Martin. Describe that case and the strange circumstances around it.
So if there's one case, probably in both books, I know better than any, it's a Dennis Martin case. And once you read about him and how he disappeared, it'll strike a chord in any parent out there. Dennis was with his dad, his grandpa, and his brother over a Father's Day weekend, and they lived in Knoxville, Tennessee. And June 14th, 69, they decided to go up to an area called Spence Field on the top of the Rockies along the Appalachian Trail. And they hike in a short distance to this field, and it looks like a field, surrounded by trees and things, but there's a field right here. And the Martin boys are out running around, and the grandparents and the grandpa and the dad are just sitting there on the field. And in these stories, every once in a while, you're going to see that I write about a very strange coincidence that happens. And as they're sitting on this field, a family walks up, which is pretty weird to begin with because he had to hike into this area. A family walks up, and they sit down, and they have kids too. And they say, oh, hi there. My name is so-and-so Martin. Mr. Martin looks at him and goes, our name is the Martins too. They said, well, can our kids sit down and play together? And he says, absolutely. So they sit down and make small talk, and in the meantime, the kids are running around the field. After a little bit, the kids decide that they're going to play hide-and-seek. Well, Dennis is one of the smaller kids, and Mr. Martin is a very, very smart man. And I've had the pleasure to meet him and speak with him. And he is aware of what's going on around him at all times. And he watched his son during this hide-and-seek game hide behind a bush 50, 60 feet away from him. And after 30, 40, 50 seconds, everybody comes out, hide-and-seek game is over, his son doesn't come out. He gets up and he walks over to the bush, and his son's not there. And he runs 2 miles down the Appalachian Trail as fast as he can, and he doesn't see anything. And he comes back, and his dad already knows what's going on. People are looking for Dennis. Red flags are going up. He sends his dad down the trail to get Park Service assistance. And within an hour or 2 hours, there's 100 guys up there, and they're looking. Make a long story short, within a couple days, there's several thousand people covering that park. And what evolves from this is one of the most unusual stories you will ever hear. And part of the fault in what's happened here, I lay directly on the media in Knoxville, and it's still ongoing. And that is that they covered the story from what the Park Service or whoever was pulling the punches here wanted them to, but they didn't tell the whole story. And that is that when Dennis disappeared, the Park Service employees and the Rangers, they weren't carrying guns at that time. They hadn't been authorized to. Yet the second day after Dennis disappears, unknowing to anybody, it's like the invasion forces arrived, and 100 Green Berets fly into the park in helicopters and establish a base there, away from the Park Service people and away from other searchers. And they set up a communications post just for them, and they search by themselves. Dwight McCarter was the head tracker for the Park Service then and recently retired, and I interviewed him as well. And Dwight said, yeah, Dave, I don't know why they didn't communicate with us. I don't know why they didn't search with us. And I don't know why they were carrying guns. But they went out and searched while we were searching. And about 100 of them. And as the people are searching, during those first hours that Dennis was gone, first few hours, a family was down below them at about 2,000, 2,500 feet in an area called Cades Cove. And they'd asked rangers where they could go to see animal life. Rangers told them an area called Rowan's Creek. And they walk up into this area, an entire family. And the boy says, Dad, look, there's a bear up there running amongst the trees. And the dad looks up and says, son, that's not a bear. That looks like almost looks like a man. And they watch this thing dart behind trees as though it doesn't want to be seen. Simultaneously, they hear the loudest scream they've ever heard in their life. This family's name, their last name was called the Key family. Keys don't know that a child's been missing. They just are walking through the park. So they get back in their car and they go home because they don't know anything's happened. Next day they read about the Martin disappearance in the paper, and they read that the FBI is on scene monitoring this case. Well, the Keys feel that what they saw was extremely important. And they call the FBI and they say, hey, we'll meet you at the park and we'll tell you and show you what we saw. And
Dave, I'm going to ask you to hold off. That music tells us we're going into the break. This is just, the story is just getting juicy here, and it gets even juicier in the sense that two other people disappeared from the very same area. Also, very unusual circumstances. We'll pick up the story after the break. Stay with us, everyone. More Coast to Coast AM coming. Coming up, we continue the conversation about this strange case of Dennis Martin, who disappeared in the Great Smoky Mountains, along with two other people, basically in the same place, all of them within line of sight of other witnesses who are in the area. Why did the Green Berets get called in? What were they looking for? We pick up the story right after this on Coast to Coast AM. All right, six-year-old Dennis Martin disappears June 1969 in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Green Berets are called in. Another family, the Key family, sees something pretty weird flitting around in the trees. Pick up the story from there, Dave.
So the Keys call the FBI, and the FBI says, no, don't come to the park. We'll come to you. Now, first of all, as an investigator, I want to see what they saw. I want to understand if it's plausible what they saw could be involved with Dennis or not. So the statement was odd to begin with. So the FBI agent and a Park Service investigator go out and meet the family, and they tell them the story. And the FBI agent appears to be calling the shots on everything. And he comes back and he tells the Park Service, ah, it's nothing, don't worry about it. It's not possible, not plausible. And Dwight McCarter hears the story, and he tells me, Dave, it was plausible, it was likely, it was the best lead we had. And I said, really? He says, well, it was within the guidelines of plausibility and time and distance. And the FBI agent says it wasn't. So a couple days go by, and nobody hears anything about this, including Mr. Martin, who had been given instructions that he would be updated on anything close to a hint of evidence he'd be told about. Well, he was never told. And what happened was is that a newspaper guy got onto the story because the Key family saw that it was given no press. Nobody followed up with him. It's like it got swept under the carpet. The Keys call the press, and the press goes out and meets with him, and they tell the press the story. So the press comes back to the FBI and the Park Service and says, well, is this true? Why weren't we made aware of it? Blah, blah, blah. And the FBI agent and the Park Service give the press an admonishment. We don't know what that was, but I'll tell you what the eventuality of it is. And they're told it doesn't fit, but, you know, you can run the story, go ahead, but it's not anything to worry about. Well, Mr. Martin hears from McCarter, no, this is within reason. So they walk the distance, and they find out that not only is that within plausibility, it's well within the guidelines of what could be real. And it's the best lead they had. They didn't have anything. So Mr. Martin's getting a little upset because he doesn't think that the Park Service is making the call on this, and he started to feel right away that his son got kidnapped, and he didn't mind telling people that. He goes, I know my son. I know how fast he can move. I know his mentality. This isn't him. There's no way he could have gotten away like as fast as he did without help, blah, blah, blah. So keep going with the search, and there's 3,000 people there. It goes on for 3 weeks, and it rains every day for 2 weeks. From the time Dennis disappeared, 2 weeks later, it rained nonstop. So, seems pretty unusual. We make a Freedom of Information Act request. We get the documents. We interview McCarter, and from reading the statements in the paper about the Key family and hearing from McCarter, the last person I wanted to talk to was Mr. Martin, but everybody told me he doesn't talk to anybody. So every once in a while, as a policeman, if you want to talk to somebody, sometimes it's best just to cold call him. Just go knock on his door. Don't give him time to think about it. Be polite, be respectful, and that's what myself and another researcher did. We went, found Mr. Martin, knocked on his door. He came to the door. I was very humble. I said, Mr. Martin, I've been researching your case for several years regarding your son. I probably know more about it than everyone but you. And if you please give me 5 minutes of your time and just answer a couple of questions, I'd be eternally grateful. And you could see tears start to come up in this guy's eyes. And he looked in the house and he said, you know, I made a promise to my wife I wouldn't talk about this anymore because it's ruined our lives. And I live with the hell of knowing that my son isn't here with me. And I just can't talk about it. And I said, hey, I came all the way from California. Can you just answer a few questions for me, please? And he looked inside at his wife. He closed the door, and he stepped onto the porch, and he gave us about 20 minutes. The man was very polite, and he is still hurt very hard by this. So I went through a series of questions, and I said, one thing I asked him is that when his son went behind the bush playing hide-and-seek, did you hear, smell, feel anything odd? He said, nothing. I said, how about your other son that was there? He said, he heard, felt, smelled nothing. He said, it was like everything was normal. And I said, is there any chance that your son could have gotten away from you that quick? He said, zero chance. There's no way. And if you look at pictures of Mr. Martin when his son disappeared and today, he's still in phenomenal shape. I believe what he's saying. And so we started to talk about the key family observation, and his eyes lit up. He says, Dave, you know about this? I said, yeah. I've researched it a lot, and it seems like that was probably your best lead. He said, yes. I said, well, why wasn't it followed up? He said, Dave, I thought the Park Service was in charge of their park. But he said, somebody else is making the calls here. It wasn't the Park Service. They were just following somebody else's orders, and I don't think it was coming from the Park Service. He says, the FBI agent said it wasn't possible to make that distance, yet McCarter and I hiked it in easily that time. And one of the last questions I asked him is, I said, you know, in an investigation, I always ask people, what should I know that wasn't publicly available but would help me understand what happened? He goes, oh, wow. He goes, people have never asked me that. He says, the first thing is the key family observation. He says, you obviously know what was printed in the paper. I said, yeah. He says, you want to know what wasn't printed in the paper is that the key family saw something running behind the trees. Well, that something was carrying something on its shoulder, but the press wouldn't print it.
Oh,
my eyes lit up. I said, you're kidding. He says, no. And I said, well, did they ever address that to you? No, they just swept it under the rug. They didn't want to deal with it. And he said, and then, you know, the FBI agent that you've been talking to me about. I said, yeah. And I said, well, from the feeling is, he said he was just monitoring this case. And Mr. Martin said, no, he was really actively involved. And it was possible from all the discussions I had with people, including McCarter, it seemed like he was the one making the calls for some odd, very odd reason. And Mr. Martin said, well, that FBI agent, he was the same one on other children's disappearances up here. And I even named the disappearances to Mr. Martin. I said, on this, he said, yes. He says, do you know whatever happened to that agent? I said, no. He says, he committed suicide. And for the people that are listening, that may not mean a lot to them. But once you understand the way the FBI manages their people, is that everything you learn in an investigation, you cannot release to anybody else without approval from a supervisor. And everything has to be held confidentially. And when somebody, an agent, is monitoring a case, they're writing case notes and reports and sending it to Virginia. And those report files are then reviewed by a profiler and placed into other files that have significant other meaning to what you may be investigating. And if there's an agent in the field that's investigating something similar, he's given information just like that. So he can work it with a more educated perspective. The implication being is that this agent was obviously told something, and this is what Mr. Martin was getting at, without it being said. He knew something that obviously hurt him and bothered him to some great degree.
Dennis Martin, 6-year-old boy, happy and healthy, a nice, normal family, also happy and healthy. You know, we're talking about it tonight, his case and among the 470 or so other cases. And it's challenging and entertaining even to consider the mystery, but it's easy to forget that each of those cases is a tragedy. It's a traumatic experience for a family. It's ruined lives. It probably stays with these people, the family members, for the rest of their lives, in part because the cases are never solved. There's never any closure.
So think about this, that Mr. Martin knew that this was a significant lead, and it was absolutely dumped by the Park Service. And I went to McCarter the next day after I talked to Mr. Martin to validate what he told me, and he confirmed it. He said, no, we knew that the Key family saw something darting between the trees, and it had something on its shoulder. I said, Dwight, how come this isn't going to the press? How come the press isn't plastering this on the front page of every paper in Knoxville? And then I even showed him every paper, and I said, it's nowhere in here. He just kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, yeah. So even to give the listeners a more educated perspective on this, is that when we were doing a release on the books, we brought the four networks from Knoxville into a motel conference room, and we laid out this Dennis Martin case to them. And just all of the factual evidence, no opinions at all, factual evidence. We had statements from McCarter, statements from Martin, the old newspaper articles, the refusal of the press to print it, and the leads pointing to what that this was a significant event. Do you know there wasn't one media outlet in Knoxville that would touch this issue? Just like they wouldn't touch it in 1961, they would not, 1969, they would not touch it in 2012.
Well, somebody did, because that's the story that I read from the AP was picked up from WVLT-TV. So perhaps after it sunk in for a while, or they felt guilty or something, but they did a story, and that's why Associated Press picked it up. So somehow you got through to them, but it wasn't very in-depth, and it seems like, from what I'm reading, that they accepted the word of the Park Service, which concluded, well, we think Dennis Martin never left the park, but we're pretty sure the other two that I want to get into, the other two disappearances, that they were taken out of the park. How they know that, I don't know.
Well, that's a great question. The other two you're talking about is a girl named Trini Gibson. Disappeared in 76. She was 16. And a woman named Thelma Melton disappeared in 81. She was 58. Talk about Gibson. She also disappeared in close proximity to the Appalachian Trail. She was with a high school group that was on a field trip, and she's walking on a trail with a group. Freedom of Information Act, I got all the documents, all the witness statements. The kids even wrote out statements of what they saw. And she's walking down a trail, and she's ahead of the group she's with, and a group sits down to take a rest. They see her walk down the trail. I've been on this trail, and it's thick. And there's a picture in the book where you're walking down that trail, and the right shoulder is bushes, and not far from the left shoulder is bushes. They see her stop on the trail and look off as she's looking at something. That was the description. She took one step off the trail. She was never seen again. Kids went down that trail a couple minutes later, and the descriptions were, we couldn't believe that she stepped off the trail in the place she did, because it was a very small and steep creek bank. And you'll keep hearing this, the kids disappear near creeks, and they're found near creeks. And as many listeners have written to me before and reminded me, this is an area where you're not going to retain footprints and tracks. You can walk on rocks all day, and you're not going to find any tracks. Well, she stepped off in this area that nobody could believe she stepped off in, and it was an absolutely huge search. There were a lot of fingers pointed in other directions as a probable cause. She ran off with a boyfriend, but if he saw where she left the trail, that's a ridiculous and stupid assumption, because you could walk for days on this area, the Appalachian Trail, or where she was at, and you would go nowhere. It's so far in the middle of nowhere, it's ridiculous. If she wanted to leave, she could have left from her home in the middle of the night and not been found. But at this point in history, she would have stepped out. She would have been known. She's never been found. They never found one evidence of her even being in the bush. There was no clothing. There was nothing of Trini Gibson ever found. And she, again, a reminder, she was the front person in line, steps off the trails, and never seen. Again, in 1981, a 58-year-old woman named Thelma Melton is staying in a group of trailers. People all knew each other. Older couples would stay right on the perimeter of the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, but outside the park. A trail leading into the park starts at the end of this private camping area and goes up into the park. And every day for probably weeks, these older ladies take a hike up this trail. And they go a couple miles up, and they turn around, and they come back. And the ladies, I think there was four or five, walk up to the end of this one point where they turn around. This trail follows right next to a creek. Thelma starts stepping a little faster than they do. She gets 20, 30, 40 feet away. They see her. They're talking. Oh, Thelma, you're pretty fast today. She laughs and says, yeah, I just want to get back to my trailer. And she goes over a short rise in the trail. And as the people come over the rise, they don't see her. And the other women think, ah, she must have just hustled down the trail and she's already back. Well, as the trail dumps down into this private camping area, there's tons of trailers there, summer campers, etc. And everyone sees everyone coming off the trail, and nobody sees Thelma come back. And again, another massive search, and they find nothing. And she is never found. And her checks are never touched. Her bank accounts are never touched. Make a long story short, it's like Trenny and Thelma got plucked out, and who knows where they ever went. And the Park Service, again, does a search, comes up with no answers. And if you looked at the Great Smoky Mountains, you would think of them entirely different than you would the Rockies or the Sierras. They're not half as steep. They're not nearly as high. Yeah, there's thick foliage, but it's not the same hazard area that you'd think of with the Sierras or the Rockies. Now, some people wrote me and they said, well, it's obvious Dennis Martin must have fallen in a mine shaft or a cave. And we thought of that, and we wrote to the Park Service, and they advised us that all of the caves and shafts in that area were sealed in the early 60s before Dennis disappeared. And they claim that there are none now. And then other theories were there was a bear. I've heard tons of theories, but none that adequately explain the inconsistencies in the explanations and the distances that the Park Service has gone to cover up facts.
The FBI, of course, does have jurisdiction when it comes to kidnappings, or at least some kidnappings, so I guess it would not be totally unusual for an FBI agent to be involved if it were a kidnapping. But the presence of the Green Berets as well, and then the FBI having some sort of a control over Park Service and what information is disseminated, that's pretty weird. Have you been able to file FOIA requests to the FBI or to the Army to see what those Green Berets were doing there?
Filed two different FOIA requests with the Army on the Green Berets, and not only did I get a denial, we filed two separate requests because we never got a response. We never got any response. We didn't get hey, no, or hey, thanks. We got zero. The FBI is probably the hardest federal agency to get any information out of that I know of. Because if somebody is dead, they cite privacy issues in releasing information, even though the person is deceased. And if the person, if you allege they're deceased, they ask for a death certificate. They make you go to that level. We get the death certificate, and then they'll say, well, because of privacy rights, we're not going to release this information. So they make you run a distance, stop, and then wait for the denial. On the documents that we have received off of the Charles McCullough case in Crater Lake, where the person disappeared and his pants were found open, that case, yeah, we got a copy of a file that was so redacted, it looked like something out of a Secret Service or a CIA file. It was ridiculous.
I know that you've covered your tracks in a lot of these areas, but of course, our listeners are sending in so many ideas what it could be, birds or drug dealers or Bigfoot. We'll cover some of those other possibilities and continue our conversation about particular cases that are of interest to you. As our conversation with Dave Politis continues, don't go anywhere. Much more of Coast to Coast coming.